Okay, shall we start? Yeah, shall we have a vote on whether we should start or not? Maybe not, not today. So let's start. So this is the thing about sitting on front row. You become a bit like a dictator. You dictate the pace of things. So what I want to talk about today is Buddhism and politics. And the reason for that is because I asked somebody recently what would be a good topic for a Dhamma talk. I was teaching something overseas, and he was saying that people were getting obsessed with politics everywhere, and that they kind of needed to take a step back and sort of look at things from a more kind of overall picture, more like a bird's eye view of things, because otherwise you just get too involved in these things. And you can see why. There's so many things seems to be happening in the world these days, both here in Australia, lots of things happening in Australia with these terrible bushfires going on, and all kind of other things as well, and of course overseas, okay, and cars kind of doing things, and that's a small politics. So all of these things happening in the world, yeah, with climate change happening and governments, and people are arguing in Hong Kong, and there is all politics and Brexits and what have you all the way around the world. So these are very kind of active times in the area of politics. And what happens when things are so active, there's so much going on, people often get really obsessed with the news and with the latest developments and what is happening. And sometimes it's a bit like you get addicted to reading the news. Is anyone here who's addicted to the news? Yeah, one over there. Okay, nodding with understanding, yeah. I certainly can see how that can happen quite easily, and occasionally you do get a bit addicted. I know many people who are addicted to these things. And so you need to take a step back, and you need to understand what is really important in life, what really matters. And I was really reminded of this when I was in Hong Kong. I went to Hong Kong about 2 months ago. And as you would have known, probably all of you know, probably, unless you've been living in a cave somewhere. Anyone living in a cave? No? Okay, so no one living in a cave. So you probably know about this, all the things happening in Hong Kong, with the kind of the pro-government side and the anti-government side, and then all the problems in the street, the demonstrations and all the violence and everything going on over there. It's really bad, yeah. It's really kind of, from a Buddhist point of view, not very kind of conducive to peace and happiness, anything like that. So I went to Hong Kong, and just when I was there, it was pretty much the worst point in these riots and things going on. So I went there, and we did a meditation retreat together. I didn't see any of the riots. I said to the Hong Kongers, I want to go and see the riots. They said, no, we're going to go to the retreat center. I said, okay then. No chance to see the... Sometimes it's nice to see some riots, see some kind of life happening. You know, when you are a monk, all you see is the nice stuff all the time. You see all the good people, all the happiness. You don't get to see real life sometimes. This is like real life, people rioting and doing bad things. So I went to this retreat, and of course on this retreat you can't hide away from this thing. That is what is so interesting here. It's nice because in Hong Kong, even though it is a very large city and a very busy city and there's lots of noise in the central parts, they have some areas that are really conducive for meditation retreats. They're far away. This was a meditation center, and when you sit down, it's a bit like sitting in this hall here today, except even more peaceful, actually, at this retreat center than even in this hall here, because it is in the countryside. So we're sitting there in this beautiful hall, meditating together, and then every evening you have a Q&A session, question and answers. It's kind of the thing, one of the things that we do to get people have the chance to kind of ask questions and that sort of thing, which is often more engaging. You get more engaged, and it's easier to have an interest if you have a chance to ask questions. We always have this on the retreats. And of course, then the questions start coming. And then one of the first questions was, well, what do you think about all this, the Chinese government? There's all this violence with the police and whatever. Isn't the government of Hong Kong, aren't they bad? Yeah, please take sides with us against the government of Hong Kong. Yeah. Yeah, and then the very next question I got was, these rioters, yeah, these students, aren't they really bad? Aren't they really evil? They're kind of using violence in the riots. And so there I was kind of a monk, caught in the middle, kind of the pro-China flank over there, the pro-demonstrator flank over there, and it was pretty much divided 50-50. I didn't know what to say. What can you say? You have to be really careful. But of course, the point is, as a Buddhist monk, you don't really take sides in political conflicts like that. The moment you take side in political things, you kind of half your crowd would have disappeared because they were actually opposed to what, you know, to what that side you might be taking. And so generally speaking, monks don't usually take sides in politics because the moment you take sides in politics, there is a, you know, there tends to be a problem in that sense. So what you do instead, you ask yourself, what are the broader principles, the more basic principles that are Buddhist, that actually underlie, if you like, all of these things. And of course, that is ideas such as non-violence, kindness, looking after each other, caring for each other, coming from a wholesome perspective. So whoever is acting from violence, whoever is acting from anger, they are the ones who have a problem. Whether that's the government or the protester doesn't really matter. That is where the problem lies. And in that sense, you can create a sense of harmony because this is something everyone can agree on. But I felt at that moment, I really felt they want me to take sides in a political matter. And sometimes you just have to be careful as a monk not to get drawn into that. So that kind of kicked off this idea of talking a bit more about politics because it is so obvious that people were obsessed. It was very obvious when I went to Hong Kong anyway. So what are some of the basic principles? And one of the nice places to start out, perhaps, is the area of, you know, when we, this is a very basic thing, but when you vote, what is a Buddhist way of voting? How should you vote to come from a Buddhist point of view? Should you vote Liberal, Labour, or Green? No, I'm joking. I'm not going to talk about that. What are the underlying ideas? How should we think when we vote? I'm not going to tell you which party to vote for because that's just divisive again. What are some of the underlying principles? And I remember some years ago, Ajahn Brahm was asked this very question. He wasn't in Australia, it was some other country, and they were just having elections. And they asked him, how should we vote? We don't know how to vote. What should we do? And Ajahn Brahm said, that instead of following or going according to what the politicians promise you, what you should be doing instead is asking you what is the track record of those politicians. Forget about the promises because they are so uncertain anyway. I don't know if you've seen that in politics. You probably see this all the time. Yeah, they promise everything, but actually very often, not far from everything happens what they promise anyway. So look at the track record. Yeah, see if they have been doing the right thing in the past. Have they been living up to whatever they say, etc. That is how you should vote. Suggested Ajahn Brahm, but just a suggestion. I think it was quite a neat suggestion. It's a different way of thinking about politics, not taking particular sides, but looking, if you like, at the integrity of the people in politics. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, maybe we can take this even a bit further. Maybe we can take this even to a deeper stage. What more can we say about this? And one of the interesting things you see in the suttas, this is a sutta that I remember reading a long time ago, and I wasn't really sure of its meaning when I first started out. But this sutta says that when the leaders in the world are immoral or unrighteous or lacking in virtue or don't kind of fulfill their duties or whatever, when that happens, then the next layer down are also going to become immoral, not fulfilling their duties properly. Leadership really matters. What the top politicians or leader in our society do, it tends to trickle down to the next layer. And if the next layer also become unrighteous and immoral and doing the wrong thing, that then trickles down to one layer down. And thus it goes all the way down until our entire society is affected by the leadership in our society. Leadership matters enormously. They often set an example. They're often there. They have kind of a large audience very often. A lot of people listening to them. And for this reason, it tends to trickle down. I don't know if you heard about the idea of trickle-down economics. Yeah, there was a kind of trickle-down economics with the idea that if we boost the economy and people at the top get, you know, if we get really wealthy, society will trickle down to everyone. And it didn't seem to work. Yeah, it didn't, you know, people further down didn't really get anything from the top, but at least that's the way it looks looks like. But trickle-down morality, that is a real thing, according to the Buddha. Morality or immorality, if you know good, trickles down into society because leadership, people look up to the leaders and they look for leadership not just in the purely politics sphere, but actually in how to live and how to be a good human being. So this is fascinating. And then the sutta goes on to say that if you are immoral, if everyone is immoral this way, it also affects society at large. It affects the food production. It affects, you know, our ability to feed each other. It affects everything after a while. And I think this is actually one of the things that we are seeing now in the world. I'll come back to this later on. But what we are, one of the things that we are seeing is we're seeing an emphasis sometimes on economic growth and these kind of things, sometimes at the expense of much broader and important issues. And that is exactly where that degree of not taking your responsibility maybe seriously enough really becomes a problem for society at large. So immorality starts with immorality, goes down in society, and the more less moral you are, the more likely it will affect the entire society in really bad ways. Even at the end of the day, society may be collapsing, people not getting enough food, and etc., etc., things going in the wrong direction. So I think that taking my lead from that example in the suit, I would say when we vote or when we elect our leaders, one way of doing it, this is just my suggestion, but this is one way, is to look at the morality of those politicians. How much integrity do they have? Are they really good people? Yeah, and sometimes forget about the ideology. Forget about whether they are to the left or the right or the center or whatever. Okay, we can argue endlessly about ideology. Ideology is, you know, equally intelligent and clever people can take opposite sides very often. Sometimes you may change your mind about ideology and politics in midlife. You can always argue about these things. But I think if we have leaders who are moral, who live well and do the right thing, that may be even more important than ideology in this world, because that sets the example. And they will, in the end, they will do the right thing if they're moral people, even if it is from a certain particular viewpoint. So that is the first thing I would suggest, which is kind of, I don't know if that, is that anyone else taught like this before? You should vote for the moral leaders. You have to really kind of have your eyes open to actually see how that works. It can be hard to uncover, but sometimes we have some idea how this happens. And then we put those people into office. Whoever we vote for, they go into office. And then they do maybe weird things, and then we start complaining about the politicians. That's kind of an illness in modern society, complaining about politicians. Everyone seems to be complaining about politicians. And sometimes I think maybe we give politicians too hard a time. It's almost as if we set them to a standard that is higher than our own standard. Sometimes I ask myself, if I was a politician, how well would I do? I don't know, I have no idea. I would try to do my very best, of course, I suppose. I would never want to be in that kind of position. But what if I was in that position? Would I really be able to do much better? And one of the things that I think we often forget is how hard these positions can be. You may start out, many politicians, I think, start out as young and very, very idealistic. They want to do something for the world. And then after you do something, you try to do something, the system is stronger than you, and it forms you and shapes you. And you kind of have to, all kind of compromises have to be done. Sometimes you compromise away your principles, and you end up doing all kind of bad things as a consequence. The system is so tough. This is what whole life is about. Life is really a system that influences all of us. And depending on which part of this world you allow to influence you and condition you, you will be conditioned in a certain way. So I think we should have more compassion for our politicians as well. Often they are doing, you may disagree with some of them, some of them may be truly bad and greedy, but there are always also a few who are good. And we need to differentiate a bit more. We need to have more compassion, more understanding for how hard it is. And there is a nice little sutta in the sutta, is a discourse by the Buddha. And the Buddha is sitting down and he's thinking. I think this may have been not so long before his actually awakening experience, and he's thinking to himself, it's as if he's making a choice, should I become awakened or should I be a king or what should I do with my life? He obviously has this feeling that he has a great potential. You can imagine someone like the Buddha would have had great potential. And so he's thinking, is it possible to rule? Is it possible to be a king and rule without, first thing he says, I think, rule without killing, I think it says. Rule without killing and causing others to die. Is that possible? Is it possible to rule without conquering and having others conquer? Is it possible to rule without sorrowing and causing others to sorrow? And you know what the answer is? Interesting answer, right? He doesn't give an answer. This is kind of weird. He doesn't give an answer to this question. Maybe because there is no answer. Maybe because it takes certain conditions for these things to be possible. Maybe it is no easy matter to decide on these things. But you will notice the thing there. Is it possible to really rule without causing death in this world? Is it possible to rule without confiscating and acquiring more land or whatever? And the last one I think is very touching. Is it possible to rule without grieving? Soka is the Pali word. Soka, without grieving and sorrowing and causing others to grieve and sorrow. This is part of the politician's life, to do things that are often you are conditioned to do. You can't avoid it because your position demands you to do things that causes sorrow for yourself and also for the people around you. It's kind of fascinating. This is kind of what the part of the problem of the world. We get tracked into this onto these rails, and then we get pushed down the railroad tracks, and we can't really move to the left or the right because the tracks keep you there. You can't get off those tracks anymore. And this is part of what politics is about. So we should set our politicians to a high standard. Of course we should, because we need good leaders. At the same time, we also need to have compassion. There's this beautiful balancing act which makes things, I think, a good Buddhist approach to politics and to dealing with these issues. So it's very difficult. And because it is so difficult, I don't know if you have noticed sometimes, I'm sure you have noticed in your life, if you vote for something, you're hoping for a certain government or certain people to be elected into power. This is kind of one of the points of elections, that we have certain hopes. And then if those hopes get shattered, you feel really let down. Oh no, I didn't want that party to get into power. Oh no, not that politician. You feel really let down. Or if your favorite politician gets into power, you feel, yay, this is it. Now things are going to get resolved. And this is part of this process. Very important now is the whole climate issue, which is kind of going up the political political importance all the time, the problem of climate change around the world. And of course, Australia kind of having serious problems because of this. So what is happening here is that what you're starting to see is how much up and down, how this kind of sometimes your hopes get realized, other times they don't get realized, and you're kind of knocked about by all of these politics and all of these things. And there is no kind of steadiness in your mind as a consequence. And what you start to see is how impossible and how unsteady the world actually is. How that hope that you have for politics to go in a certain way, the hope you have for climate change to get sorted out by politics, and all of these things, how it always tends to get dashed, where it gets good, and then it gets dashed again. And it's always moving around in this way. And the reason for that is because many of these things, they don't really have, there is no final solution to many of these things. In the political realm, things are often so complex and so hard, things move back and forth, and there often is no final solution to these problems. The problems come back again, and then they disappear for a while, and then someone else gets elected into office, and the round of politics is always so utterly unreliable and uncertain, and this is part of the problem here. So one of the things that happens when you see the world like that, when you see the world as out of control, including also the realm of politics, including whatever else is happens in that realm, what starts to happen is that you start to lose your interest in that realm. The reason that you have an interest in the realm of politics is because you think that there are solutions in that realm. And there will be, occasionally there will be solutions, short-term solutions, and then there is no solution anymore because suddenly it goes in the wrong way. And who knows where everything is heading down the track. So remember that, and actually it takes away some of your interest in that world of politics. You become less obsessed because you understand that actually where it's going to go next is utterly out of your control. It is so completely unreliable. And one of the interesting things about this, to my mind anyway, is, well, why is it so out of control? What is it that, why is it so hard to come up with a political system, whether it's democracy or a social democracy or socialism or capitalism or whatever it is? Why is it so hard to come up with a system that actually works? Yeah, a system that we can kind of stick with, we can stay with, and now we can carry on with that system because it actually has the ability to do what is right for this world. Why is it so hard? Why is there indeed no, seemingly, apparently, no stable system that we can always hang out with, that we can always use, a kind of utopian system? Yeah. Well, first of all, why is it that people are so keen on utopias? We have so many utopias in human history. Communism, socialism, capitalism is probably a kind of utopia as well. Libertarianism, whatever it is, or even democracy. Why are people so keen on these things? And the reason why we are keen on these things is because we want certainty. It's one of the fundamental things that we crave as human beings, a sense of stability, the idea that things will then carry along and we don't have to worry about change and uncertainty anymore. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice to have a system we didn't have to worry about all the uncertainty all the time? Things were kind of stabilized. And I think this is the thing that drives human beings to create utopian system of politics, whatever it is, Marxism, yeah, and these kind of things. But it is a misguided from a Buddhist point of view. From a Buddhist point of view, you cannot have a final system, a utopian system. From a Buddhism, you can always just have change, moving on, things being undermined. And the reason for that is the deep kind of defilements in the human mind. Yeah, especially defilements like greed, hatred and delusion. These are the root defilements. And of those, I think greed is probably the one that causes most problems in this world. Yeah, this greed is always trying to undermine the existing system, because greed always says, I want more, either for myself, for my family, for my society, or whatever it is. There's always this idea that we want more. So because greed is a fundamental part of human beings, something you can't really get rid of unless you become an arahant, but there are not that many arahants around, unfortunately. I usually like to ask at a point like this, how many arahants are there in the audience? And you usually don't get that many hands being raised, yeah? So that shows you how problematic it is. There always is this fundamental greed is always there. And greed distorts our society. Greed takes advantages of the loopholes in the system that you have created. Yeah, we saw that with, why didn't Marxism work? Why didn't communism work? It may have looked good on paper, perhaps, but in reality, people use the system for their own power, for their own aggrandizement, for all of these kind of things. Why doesn't democracy? Well, democracy has worked really reasonably well, but democracy also is susceptible to exactly the same problem. Lobbying groups, people trying to take it over. Yeah, people with a vested interest. In other words, it comes from greed. Yeah. So whatever you create, there cannot be stability here, because there are root things in the human mind that will always undermine any kind of stability you have in society here. So what does that mean? Why is this important? And the reason why it is important is because once you understand that there cannot be any stability, once you understand that politics is inherently out of control and is really problematic, it turns you off. Yeah, it makes the world seem so much less attractive. We always have this idea of moving towards something, a goal, something there which is sustainable, something which makes the world a better place. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work, but ultimately it's out of control. And when it's out of control, what happens then is, if you are wise about it, you start to move your mind in a different direction, away from those things that are inherently out of control, towards things you can actually do something about. And that is, of course, the spiritual realm. Another example I should bring up also of what greed does, I think to me it is fairly obvious that the whole problem of climate change that we have, people now calling it climate disaster and climate catastrophe and all these kind of things, because it seems to be going so badly. So why is it that you hear governments, not all governments, but many governments around the world still saying we have to prioritize economic growth over these climate issues? When I read that, I think, what's going on here? And what I see is what looks like to me as a Buddhist monastic, it looks like people are driven by greed. Greed, economic growth, is ultimately about greed in a certain way. We have to have growth. Where does that come from? It comes from a desire for more, ultimately rooted in greed. It looks like we're allowing greed to hijack the agenda of having a livable planet. What if down the track there is no economy? What happened to economic growth? If there is no economy, you can't have growth anymore. So isn't that kind of getting a bit sidetracked? Aren't we kind of on the wrong track with this? And I find that the logic seems to me to be so weird. Yeah, economic growth before looking after the planet. There's no logic there. It's kind of turning things upside down. But it is certainly following, yeah, some of these root kind of driving forces in the human mind. That is what is following. So we shouldn't really be that surprised. So again, yeah, showing you why these root things are so problematic and how they make ultimately the world so out of control that we have no idea what's going to happen next, where it's going to go. So this is all just to kind of lead you a little bit. One of the things that the Buddha is talking about in the suttas, another thing, I always like to come back to what the Buddha says. And one of the kind of beautiful things I have mentioned here before is a type of perception and a type of way of thinking about the world. Yeah, we all know that. Maybe you don't, actually. I have no idea whether you know this, but maybe some of you will know it, because I know you so well. I know a little bit about what you know, not exactly what you know. But one of the kind of root things in Buddhism is the idea of right view. Yeah, right view is looking at the world in a certain way, seeing the world clearly for what it is. And very often we think about right view in terms of, yeah, you have to believe in rebirth and karma and these kind of things. And these things actually really matter. They are very important. But in a more basic way, in a more fundamental way, what these deep things actually point to is this understanding that the world is inherently out of control. Yeah, it is inherently problematic. And one of the things the Buddha talks about is something he calls the Sabbaloka Anabirattisanya, which I mentioned here before. But I really like that phrase because it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Sabbaloka Anabirattisanya. You like that? It's a good word. It's a pretty good word, isn't it? Yeah, I like that word. It's long and it's Pali, so it also impresses people when you say words like this. So learn a few words like that and you can really impress your fellow Buddhists. But anyway, we come to the meaning. The meaning is really what matters here. Sabba, entire, all, loka, world, the whole world, anabirati, non-delight. Yeah, sanya, perception, the perception of non-delight in the entire world. And this is what you start to get when you see the world is so out of control. You start to move a little bit in that direction. The world is no longer interesting. What is that world? Well, that world is the world of your five senses. It's the world you experience daily through your interaction with other people, through what you see on TV or you read in the papers or on the internet or whatever. I don't know where people get their information from these days. I became a monk before the, you know, Facebook and all that kind of stuff, so I don't really know much about it. But wherever you get it from, yeah, whether it's fake news or real news or whatever, it's kind of, out of control. It is not so interesting. That whole world becomes less interesting. And this is not bad. Yeah? This should not allow you to become depressed or sad. This is not bad, because if you use this in a wise way, what it does, it turns you in a different direction. Instead of turning you towards an interest in things that are unreliable, and if they are unreliable, it means it will give you suffering down the track, because you are relying on the unreliable. You're taking refuge where no refuge should be taken. Then you're going to suffer down the track. So instead, you take your refuge in something that is more reliable at the very least. What is that thing that is more reliable? The spiritual path. Why is it more reliable? Because the spiritual path is an inner path. It is how you react to the world outside you. It's how you live your life. It is your ethical and moral decisions. And your ethical and moral decisions are always in your power, at least to some extent. You can do something about that. So you turn your mind away from that, from the world. It doesn't mean you don't care about the world. In fact, you care more for the world, because now you're coming from a more positive point of view. But you also know that higher than caring for the world is caring for your own spiritual practice. That is what matters. You start to live more ethically. You start to treat people around you in a different way. You understand that what we do is more important in life than the results that we actually get. How we live is more important than moving towards specific goals, because the goals are uncertain, problematic, unreliable, out of control anyway. So how do we do this? How do we live the spiritual life? And I just came back from Singapore yesterday, and I was in Thailand also on that trip, but I had another trip to Thailand a few weeks before on a secret mission. Don't ask me what it was, it's secret, okay? So it's actually not that secret, but I like, you know, it makes it more interesting if it's secret, so I like to say it's secret, just for the sake of it. So I was in Thailand anyway, and I when I went there, I met some very interesting monks and also a nun. I met the senior nun in all of Thailand. She's a really, really kind of strong kind of woman, and she kind of started the whole bhikkhuni tradition in Thailand by herself. And she's really great, actually. So I met her, and I met a couple of really great monks as well. And one of the monks I met was a monk called Ajahn Ganha. Some of you probably heard of Ajahn Ganha. He was here in the BSWA probably long before the majority of you here ever came to this place, back in 1988. Yeah, that was before I became a monk even. What was I doing in 88? Oh, nothing very wholesome, I think. So I don't want to think about that. So it was before I was a monk. I was still kind of running around doing silly things. So he was here. So some of you will have known him from that time. Yeah, and so he was very close to the Buddhist society here, very close to Ajahn Ganha and all of this, Ajahn Brahm and all of this. So I went to visit him in his monastery in Thailand. And he, when you come there, the first thing I will tell you a secret telling a secret is kind of not the right thing in a room like this. Anyway, it's not really a secret. If you ever go to Ajahn Ganha in Thailand, the first thing to say is I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, say that first of all, then he will kind of take you under his wing, and he will look after you a little bit more. That's what I do. I always say, oh, I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. I say, oh, okay, well, sit next to me over here. Yeah, so sit over there. It also helps. I must admit, it helps quite a bit to be quite a senior monk as well. That does help a little bit. Yeah, so. So he sits you there just next to him, yeah, and then you kind of sit next to this monk. Thai, small little monk, yeah, really overweight, and kind of he kind of looks like he doesn't look super duper healthy or anything like that. And then he starts talking, yeah, sits on this kind of little crown, yeah, this kind of big kind of seat, yeah, and all these lay people sitting around him, and I sit there on the side, yeah. And so you look at him, you're a little bit, you're not really sure what to make of this monk, until he looks at you, yeah, he looks at you in the eye, and now, whoa. Yeah, it's a bit like those kind of, those movies where kind of lasers come out of their eyes, it feels a bit like that. But these are really benevolent lasers, yeah, you get this feeling of incredible energy in this person, but also very benevolent, very beautiful energy when you sit down next to this person. So you realize that it feels like you are in the presence of someone really special. All that energy, all that kindness, where can it come from if it isn't from developing your mind to the max? And I would really recommend you to visit some of these people, because the thing is that when you read about Buddhism in books, yeah, okay, it's nice to read about it in books, but when you see some of these people who have lived this path to what may look like they have lived it to the end, and you get a real feeling for Buddhism, that's when it really makes it come alive. This is what it's like, yeah, when it's really practiced, this is actually what happens to you. So it's actually very useful to see people who have practiced this path almost to what you think might be the very end of the path. Ajahn Brahm is a bit like that too, yeah, sometimes it can be very, very powerful. But sometimes you need a bit of variety, so it's kind of nice to go to Thailand and see this little, tiny little Thai monk, yeah, he's a bit like that. And so very useful just to see that. And also he has all these quirks, he's a very quirky monk, yeah? And it's strange, because usually if you had those quirks, you know, if I tried to do some of the things that he did, you would probably walk out of the hall and think this monk is nuts. But if you have that kind of power, you can get away with things that no one else can get away with. So he sits there and has this kind of, you know, he does all kind of weird stuff. He sits there, has a kind of massive bowl with sweets, and it has a little dipper. He dips it into his bowl and he throws the sweets out. Yeah, and it kind of rains sweets. And then his smile is so sweet at the same time that you just feel it's okay, it's good. And then everyone kind of, you know, gets up quickly, get hold of your little packets of sweets. And then these sweets, when you take them back home, they kind of remind you of Ajahn Ganha, yeah, sweet person, and then you eat a sweet from the sweet person. There's kind of beautiful symbolism there. Huh? And then he has all these little drinks and all of these things standing there. So you have a big crowd in front of him, huh? And he takes these drinks and he throws out the drinks to you. Huh? So you have to, you know, catch the drinks. Huh? So sometimes it hit people in the eye, etc. But but you get hit in the eye by Ajahn Gandha, no problem. Yeah, or loving kindness, metta, is no issue at all. So it works a little bit like that. Sometimes you get away with things when you have that kind of power, which no one else can get away with. So then you listen to his teachings. Yeah, his teachings are kind of interesting. What is a monk like this going to say? Yeah, he's really powerful. He's probably going to tell you dependent origination in forward and backwards order, cessation order and origination order. And he's going to kind of explain all the details, how every link links on to the next one and how it kind of untangles when it's etc., etc. Surely he has the power for all these things. Yeah, he's really advanced. He knows exactly how these things work. Yeah, okay, Ajahn Gandha. So, but before you have a chance to ask some stupid question from him, he starts teaching. And when he starts teaching, the teachings are so simple. Yeah, and this is one of those things that I always kind of noticed how some of the most powerful monks have the most simple teachings, or the most probably powerful nuns or lay people, anyone who's powerful, really, really simple teachings, getting down to basics, yeah? So every time I start to kind of, you know, come up with some really complex teachings about dependent origination, I start to feel a bit self-conscious. It's as if I'm giving away the game, and I'm not really up there, you know, with these other monks or whatever. But so simple. And it's so powerful when you listen to it. Coming from, it is where it comes from, is far more important you realize than actually what people say. So he says things like, when you live your life, you should always be generous. In everything you do, yeah, when you even when you meditate, he says, the act of meditation should be one of generosity. So when you sit down and you close your eyes and you tell yourself, I'm doing this for the whole world, for all the people around me, yeah, it takes away the kind of selfishness that meditation sometimes feels like. Yeah? Because people often complain about all these meditators that are selfish, as looking after themselves. But no, instead of thinking like that, think, I'm doing this, I'm meditating for the whole world. And it's actually true. We are that, do that. Because when you meditate, you actually become a better person. When you become a better person, you become more able to look after other people in the world. You have a better heart. You connect with people in a better way and all of these things. You are actually practicing for the benefit of the whole world just by doing a bit of meditation practice. And not only that, but if that is your attitude in meditation, your meditation is going to become far better. If you focus on yourself and you think, I'm doing this for myself, it's going to detract from your ability to become really peaceful and have that good feeling in a meditation. But if you instead think, I'm doing this for everyone else, this is my gift to the world, that I'm sitting down, closing my eyes for half an hour, whatever it is, it becomes so much better. So try that next time. Yeah, these are little tricks, but sometimes very powerful, if you can, you know, get it going, very, very powerful ways of ensuring that your meditation actually takes off. And when it comes from a person like that, wow, it's really worth listening to. So that was only part of it, because he was going on at how you can make everything into an act of kindness. Everything can be an act of generosity, even your meditation practice, he said. And this is the way you start to live more spiritually. One of the other things that he said, what was very fascinating, which is also very simple, and it's a thing I think is very easy to forget in our busy and ordinary daily lives, is how powerful our speech is. And remember, every time you open your mouth, there's two things that can come out. Either the thing that you say can be for the benefit and for the happiness of people around you, it can lift them up. If you speak with care and compassion, if you speak things that are meaningful, coming from a soft place inside, yeah, bringing people together, whatever it is, people will feel good in your company. They will feel it's so nice to hear you speaking. Yeah. Or things that come out of your mouth can be, you know, frogs and I don't know, is it frogs that come out of your mouth? I'm not sure. Whatever it is that comes out of your mouth, which is not so poor frogs, they probably, you know, don't want to hear anything about that. But whatever comes out of your mouth, which isn't so nice, yeah, it is so easy in our daily life to get it wrong and to kind of say things that are a bit too harsh, a bit too rushed, and we don't really consider properly how it affects other people. But it affects other people enormously. And you know that. Every one of us knows that, because we know that when we hear good speech spoken in the right way, it feels good. Yeah, we feel really happy when someone tells us in the right way about, you know, whatever it is, and you know, that you feel that they care for you. Yeah, you feel that they're really trying their best to be kind to you. You can really feel that, and it really lifts you up, and it makes your day. Yeah? And remember, each one of you, you too have that power to make another person's day by speaking in the right way. Every time you say something right, don't speak too much, yeah, because that also destroys it. Speak, hold back a little bit on the amount of speech, but when you speak, do it in the right way, and you guarantee you will reach the hearts of people around you. And even if they don't acknowledge it, even if they are in a rush, maybe even if they feel a bit embarrassed because you're so kind, they kind of move on. Still, I guarantee you will reach their hearts. Yeah, and when you think about how much we speak in our life, how often we talk, there's an almost endless possibility of kindness. Endless possibility of being generous in how we treat other people simply by the way we talk to them. So this was some of the things. I knew these things already, of course, when I went to see him. But there's something very powerful when someone like that tells you these things. It drives home the point, yeah, how important these things are. And if you base that on the idea of right view, I just mentioned before the right view, how the world is so unreliable. Keep that right view at the back of your mind. When you go back home, when you go back to your work, when you go back to your daily activities, always remember where real happiness is to be had. If you remember that real happiness is not really to be found in the world, because the world is always going to let you down at the end of the day. Real happiness is found in your heart. Real happiness is found in how you practice the spiritual path. If you keep that at the back of your mind all the time, you will be able to speak rightly when it is required, even to think rightly when it is required, and to be generous at almost any time, because you know, you understand, this is what life really is about. Okay, that is all I'm going to say for tonight. Anyway, there you are here. Oh yeah. Okay, anyone. So does anyone have any questions or comments or whatever? Yeah. Thank you very much. That is very kind of you. So now, you don't want to say anything? Yeah. Nobody wants to say anything. Wow, that's really nice. Everyone really contented and happy. Let's take... Oh, I just lost it. What do I have to press to get it? Messages, is that the one? No. Oh, wrong one. Uh-oh. I don't use this device. I'm not sure how to go about using it. My fault. Okay, wonderful. Thank you. I'm glad I didn't delete everything here. Okay, so let's go for these questions. And if you think of any questions as we go along, you're more than welcome to ask them afterwards. This is from Saurabh in India. And hello in India. It's really nice to hear from the Buddha's home country. Yeah, so hello Saurabh. So the question is, what should be the ideal model of governance per the Dhamma, which can enable the governments across the world to spread peace and happiness instead of hatred? This is, I think, is a very good question, and it is not something that is answered very specifically in the word of the Buddha, because the Buddha is really about spiritual matters and about the spiritual path very specifically, and not so much about how to sort out the world. But sometimes you do get indications in the suttas, and one of those, I think, very important indications is that the leaders in the world need to be moral, and take that idea of morality very seriously, because it tends to trickle down, and we get a good society if everyone is moral. This is one of the important indications you find in the suttas. Another interesting indication is where you have, there's a particular kind of monarch found in the suttas called the wheel-turning monarch. And the wheel-turning monarchs are the ideal monarchs from a kind of Buddhist or Indian perspective. All these ideas come from India. And the wheel-turning monarch, the one way that he is described, and one of the descriptions is actually how society declines, starting from a high level, and then how it declines. And one of these descriptions is, as long as the government supports its people, Yeah, so if there are people in the world who are really poor, people who haven't got enough to make a proper livelihood for themselves, yeah, people who are hungry and starving, it is the government's job to support people like that so they are able to make a living for themselves. Yeah, in other words, to give grants to them, to hand out, to help the homeless. It's a kind of a blight on the surface of humanity right now. Everywhere travels all these homeless people everywhere. A lot of them suffering from very serious mental problems and all these kind of things. It's terrible that we can't look after our citizens better. And in some countries that are succeeding finally to do something about this. I think Finland is one of the leading examples of building homes. It's a simple solution. You build simple homes and you put them in those homes and then you look after them and support them to get them back on track again. It's not rocket science to solve these problems, yeah? If you want to solve it, you will solve it. It's just a matter of will sometimes. So this is one of the things he says, you support the people, you help the people, yeah? And then as you do that, the majority will then live up to that trust and they will then act in the right way. I know that sometimes people are concerned that if you give out too many hands up, people will take advantage. But in my experience, the majority don't take advantage. The majority live up to the trust you put in them. There's always going to be a small minority that takes advantage, but let that be. Who cares? As long as we can support the majority of people, I think that is the most important thing here. So that is kind of what you find there. So what kind of society is that? Is that a socialist society? Not necessarily. Yeah, it doesn't say anything about how you run the economy. It just says that you look after the disadvantaged and the people in society who are falling through the cracks and are not really taken care of. Personally, I think that is certainly from the suttas, and it seems to me to be a reasonable way of doing things. Otherwise, you end up getting social upheavals and all kind of problems because it just isn't sustainable otherwise. So anyway, that's a couple of examples from that. Another example in the suttas is also the idea of doing things in harmony. This is found specifically for the Buddhist Sangha, the monastics, to do meetings and do the business you have to do in society in harmony. I think that is something we could really need in the modern world, is actually to have more harmony in our society. There's so much division, yeah, so much polarization between the different politicians and parties, and it's really sometimes terrible. And that polarization and spread is like a cancer almost, again, through society. What the politicians do then tends to affect everyone else, and everyone gets polarized, and you can't have a conversation anymore or any kind of proper debate, and instead you just have all these problems and instead in the world. So coming back to the idea of harmony, where we respect each other, why is there so much disharmony? Well, in part because we don't see the opposition as proper human beings. Yeah, we think that our mates, we are the only ones, everyone else, they're just a bunch of scallywags. But if you look at it that way, you're never really going to be able to have harmony. We need to remember the humanity of the opposition, the humanity of everyone else. And when you remember the humanity of people, regardless of where they come from, regardless even of their political views, yeah, they're still human beings. Even people who may have very different political views from you, who sometimes can be really dodgy, some of those political views, they are still human beings deep down somewhere. We are all human beings. We have far more in common than what actually differentiates us. So it's always possible to have. So we need more of that compassion for each other. We need more of these things. And then maybe we can live more in harmony as a consequence. Instead of all this division, yeah? Oh no, they are Muslims. Muslims don't deserve any compassion. Of course they could deserve compassion. There are reasons why some people behave the way they do. The majority of Muslims too are really good people. I met some I don't know many Muslims, but some of the ones I met have been extraordinarily nice and friendly people. And this kind of portrayal you sometimes get is often so unfair and so unreasonable. They are human beings. They suffer just like us. They have difficulties in life they would want to overcome. They want to be happy just like us. When we think of the world like that, then there is a chance of harmony in this world. So don't allow yourself to be divided by the divisive forces of the world. Anyway, question number two. This is from D.Y. in the USA. Where do you find wise and mature politicians when everything sounds like a business deal? There are I think there are wise and mature politicians. If you look carefully enough, there will be wise and mature politicians. Yeah, you just have to make sure that you do your background checkups and you look carefully. And there are still idealists in our world, people who want to do the right thing, people who, you know, who want to do what is right. And if you find that it is difficult on the national level, then maybe start with the local government. Local government people will often be much more low-key. Yeah, there's less kind of influence, less greed and less power trips because it's small time. And very often you find very idealistic people, I think, in these areas. So look carefully here. And I think if you look carefully, you will find good people everywhere here, because that's just the nature of people. People who want to do good, sometimes they will want to get into positions of power to help them to do good. So I think you will find that if you look carefully here. Otherwise, maybe you should stand yourself. Yeah, DY, you want to stand as a politician? I don't know if you are keen on that, but maybe you can. Yeah, we need some good politicians. I was just in Malaysia, not a few days, but a couple of weeks ago, and there was a politician in the audience. And I had just said before that if you are a politician, you get kind of, the system is stronger than you, so you end up kind of becoming part of the system. That's what I said. And afterwards, I said, actually, I'm a politician. I said, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, well, you know, there are exceptions, I said. And there are exceptions, of course. There are always exceptions. There's no rule without an exception, as the strange English saying goes. I'm not sure what that saying actually means, but that's what the saying is. There are people with integrity. There are people in this world who are very strong. And especially if you are a person who live based on strong principles, if you have very clear principles about how you live your life, maybe built on Buddhist ideas or whatever they are, then sometimes you are able to withstand the pressure, especially if you don't care about being re-elected. That is kind of one of the critical things, yeah? If you don't get re-elected, fine, principles are more important. Anyway, something like that, yeah? I don't want to go too far down the track of politics because it is a bit of a dangerous field there. Okay, third question from Hadil. Why does it seem that innocent people are suffering and paying the price that those corrupt governments should pay? This is the nature of life, yeah? Life can often be very harsh. And if you have been born as a human being, all of these things are possible, being born as a human being. You think that you are born as a human being and you think that your life should have a certain shape. You should become 80 years old, you should always be healthy, you shouldn't be oppressed by governments, you should never lose your job, your wife should stay with you, your husband should stay with you for the rest of your life, there should be no divorce, your children should behave. This is how we sometimes fantasize about life. But life is all of these things and not all of those things. Yeah, sometimes you are oppressed by government. Sometimes you do have to bear the brunt of what is unfair and unreasonable. That is part and parcel of what it is like to be a human being. Yeah, when you look around the world and you see all the human beings out there, this is what it is. And you can expect yourself, eventually, at some point in the future, if you keep on getting reborn, you too will have to go through similar kind of problems. It's actually one of the suttas, where the Buddha says that when you look out into the world and you see people in misery and in problems, you can be absolutely sure that you too have been in that situation in the past, because this is the nature of human life. But of course, in the long run, if the government really is corrupt and really is dodgy, then of course those people will have to also to bear the brunt of the consequence of what they have done. When you come to the end of your life and you feel what you have done, how you have lived, and if you have lived in a corrupt way, in other words, you have enriched yourself at the expense of other people's suffering, how do you think you feel at the end of your life? You're on your deathbed, you look back, you have enriched yourself. Now all those riches have to be left behind. You can't take them with you beyond the grave. Everything has to be left behind. And the only thing you carry with you is the bad conscience and the bad mind state that you have created as a consequence of that. If you think about it, it's madness. How can you be so short-sighted? Yeah, how can you be so stupid? And the majority of people in the world are silly, stupid, yeah, and part of the reason is because And again, part of the problem is a lack of right view. Yeah, this is one of the reasons why the idea of rebirth matters so enormously, because you have a more long-term perspective. You think about things differently. How can you gain all this worldly gain by being corrupt and then destroy your own life in the process? You come to your death and it's all destroyed. The future looks really, really bleak. It's madness when you think about it. How can you not have compassion for those stupid politicians or whoever it is, or governments who act on corruption? They are fools. They are creating more suffering for themselves than for anyone else. This is the reality of it. So this is how you have to think. You have to have compassion all the way around for those people who are being exploited or who have to bear the brunt of the foolish governments, but also for the government officials, because everyone is just blind. They're blind leading the blind, no one knowing what they're doing. And again, if you think like this, it will just help you to practice the spiritual path, because you really start to understand the problem of worldly existence. And this is what comes out of this. Okay. Any questions? Anyone? Eddie. Yay, Eddie. Okay, good. A night is never complete without Eddie asking a question. So please, Eddie.
Make sure that I don't let in trouble. Ajahn Brahmali, I see the problem of the world as a very weak United Nations, you know.
Okay.
Seems like it's like in this United Nations, you know. Being United Nations, they should exert more force, you know, okay? And maybe implement rules, regulations for the world to follow in the right way, you know, like a guidance, you know. We don't see that, you know. What I see is, I might be wrong, it's just solving all these different problems, bits and pieces, should be a United Nations, you know.
Not the disunited nations.
Yeah. And then also the world system, it's all the time, the whole world is evolving.
Yeah.
It's evolving, you know, changing, you know.
Yeah.
So we need a really good this case, if we could, some like a leader to lead, you know.
I agree with the idea that we need to cooperate more, you know. I really agree on that idea, and I think that a lot of the problems we have in the world are international problems, and we should really work more together. I think that is I agree with you. We need more harmony, follow more Buddhist principles to have that harmony, and then yay, everything will be great. But it may not work out.
As a mediator, someone leading, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to choose to take the job, Eddie? We need a volunteer. We need someone to take the job. Okay, everyone. Anyway, so enough for tonight. So let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha together.
Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasango Sanghang Namasami.